From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. It is cold in St. Louis. I mean, really cold. Next hour, some incredible information regarding how long you will live with Christian Wild. So make sure you're part of that important program. Well, here's some news. An astronaut drove from Houston to Florida, donned a disguise, and then confronted a woman that she believed was romantically involved with a space shuttle pilot that she was in love with. She was charged with attempted kidnapping and other counts. She wore a wig, trench coat, and diapers so she didn't have to stop driving. U.S. Navy Captain Lisa Nowak, she's 43 years old, who flew last July on a shuttle mission to the International Space Station, was also charged with attempted vehicle burglary with battery, destruction of evidence, and battery again. She was denied bail. In Texas, an influential state senator and close ally of Governor Rick Perry has urged him to rescind his executive order, making Texas the very first state to mandate vaccinations for girls against the sexually transmitted virus that causes cervical cancer. State Senator Jane Nelson, who's the chairwoman of the Senate's Health and Human Services Committee, said lawmakers should have been allowed to hear from doctors, scientists, and patients before the state implemented such a sweeping mandate. She says this is not an emergency. It needs to be discussed and debated. The governor ordered the Texas Health and Human Services Commission to adopt rules requiring the Merck & Company, that's the big pharmaceutical company, their new vaccine for girls entering sixth grade as of September 2008. Merck is doing a lobbying campaign around the country to get state legislators to approve this. Russia and China have now banned British poultry imports as Britain neared the end of a cull of 160,000 turkeys after the nation's first outbreak of a deadly strain of bird flu in farmed poultry. Workers wearing white protective suits, black gloves, masks loaded the turkeys into crates to be gassed following the discovery of the H5N1 strain of avian flu on a farm in eastern England. Iran was set to make some fantastic claims on the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, including finding an herbal cure for AIDS, according to an Israeli news agency. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was set to speak of his nation's great achievements on February 11. Along with the claim of nuclear rights, Ahmadinejad was set to tout a purported herbal cure for AIDS. The drug's name is called IMOD, and they say it's completely effective and safe with no proven side effects. The report could not be verified. The mysterious death last month of a top nuclear Iranian physicist involved with the Islamic Republic's current effort to enrich uranium apparently was the work of Mossad, according to a leading U.S. intelligence company claims. Mossad, of course, is the Israeli security service. The death of the nuclear scientist was not announced until January 21st, 6 days after his death, by a Iranian radio network. The official cause of death was reported as gas poisoning. According to the London Times, Stratfor, a U.S. security company, reported on Friday that its sources within Israel identified the scientist as a Mossad target and said very strong intelligence suggested that the security service had assassinated him. Israel has warned Iran that it would not be permitted to threaten the Jewish state with annihilation. Turner Broadcasting System and a company called Interference, Inc. have agreed to pay $2 million to make amends for last Wednesday's marketing scheme that led to the bomb scare in Boston, you might recall. TBS is the parent company of the Cartoon Network and its Adult Swim group, which initiated the marketing scheme. It is also the parent company of CNN. The settlement included about $1 million to cities and state agencies for their response and another million in goodwill funding. Interference, the marketing company and contractor of Turner Broadcasting, hired two men to place 38 electronic devices in locations in and around Boston. Those two men have been charged. They were not part of this settlement agreement. President Bush has asked a Democratic-run Congress to approve $700 billion in new military spending. much of it for the Iraq War and Afghanistan and to curb many domestic programs. Mr. Bush also warned that even more money for Iraq could be needed as he unveiled a $2.9 trillion budget request for fiscal year 2008. On the domestic front, the president called for making his 2001 and 2003 tax cuts permanent. Some of Mr. Bush's proposed savings would come in very sensitive health programs. Mr. Bush would squeeze $66 billion over 5 years in savings from Medicare and $12 billion from the Medicaid health program for the poor in order to support the increase in military spending. Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City mayor, whose popularity soared after his response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks, has moved closer to a full-fledged campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. In a sign that he's serious about running for the White House, the two-term mayor was filing what is called a so-called statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission. In Indiana, an Indiana man was killed while putting coins in a parking meter. He's 71 years old. He was standing on a sidewalk when a driver in a Ford Ranger struck the parking meter, pinned him underneath its front bumper. He died instantly. Amateur paleontologists in India have found a remarkable trove of dinosaur eggs, about 100 of the fossilized eggs. They believe them to be between 100 and 65 million years ago, and they say that they come from three types of sauropod dinosaurs, but they wouldn't be too specific on about that. I wonder if they can ever clone those later, and we can do our own Jurassic Park. In St. Louis, over the skies yesterday, everybody was looking at what they thought were UFOs. As a matter of fact, it was over five Midwestern states. I think it was a meteor shower. That's probably what it was. The fifth annual Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo is going to be this coming weekend in Los Angeles. A number of incredible guests are going to be there. I've got two of them in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dick Sutphin is the president of the American Board of Hypnotherapy. He's known as America's leading past life therapist. As a specialist in brain-mind technology, Dick instructs medical professionals in how to use his life-changing techniques. He has created over 300 mind programming CDs. He's a featured speaker at professional hypnosis conferences and has appeared on more than 400 radio and television shows. He will be at the Conscious Life Expo in L.A. this weekend. He's our guest for a moment here on Coast to Coast. Hey, Dick, how are you?
I'm doing good, George. I'm doing fine. How about you?
You are in one incredible field. I have always been fascinated with hypnotherapy. Now, here's a question.
Okay.
If everybody goes through it, will they all have a past life experience?
Yes, sir. They actually will. That's one thing that I feel I can pretty much prove, George, is that we all have many, many memories locked away in the subconscious mind. And if they're actually set up correctly, why, they will see past lives. Yes, absolutely. And there'll be past lives that are affecting the current life. That's where the value comes in, is that we find out why somebody has a particular problem or an affinity or a block. It's a very powerful technique.
Do we always get better as we go from life to life to life experience, or do we sometimes regress, I guess?
I think we can. Yeah, I think we can regress. I think somebody like Hitler comes along, he probably regressed a long way. So there's enough free will involved.
Maybe he was Attila the Hun, though, before.
Well, maybe he was. And maybe, of course, he was, you know, serving a need for people that wanted to balance their karma. It's a hard way to look at it. But I think we have enough free will that we can regress. We hopefully are going to make the sort of choices and decisions that are going to have us increase our vibrational rate as we move through life. That's what we came here to do, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, let go of our fears and learn to express compassion and grow. It's all about growth.
How did you get involved in this field?
Boy, I took a class in self-hypnosis, boy, longer ago than I can remember. And as a bonus, the teacher was going to regress you at the end of the six-week class if you took it. And I did, and he regressed me, and I was blown away by what I saw. I was back in a country I'd never really hardly heard of, Copan, Honduras, a city and country. And I had vivid experiences with seeing with my inner eyes. And they were so powerful, I stopped at a library on the way home from the session and did some research on Copan, Honduras at the time that I was supposedly perceiving within. And I saw things. In other words, when I was in the regression, I saw the sun going down, and it was reflecting off the face of the main temple, which said to me, well, basically the temple faced west. And so, sure enough, on the way home at the library, I was able to get maps of the layout of that particular Mayan city, and the main temple did face west. And so I was just intrigued at this point, George. I had to learn more, and I started studying hypnosis, and I started exploring techniques that I guess nobody had really played with before, group regression, and whether or not people could speak a foreign language under hypnosis when directed back into the past, and on and on and on, all sorts of experiences. And the more I explored, the more intrigued I became, is basically it. And I've never been able to stop since.
How many people have you hypnotized in your career, Dick?
Oh, God, they say, those who are keeping track, which is primarily my office, but it's about 175,000 in seminars and workshops and expos and festivals, this sort
that's
of
a
thing.
Lot of, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. It really is a lot of people. And, of course, those are in group sessions. I've done thousands of people individually. But, yeah, it's a lot of people. So, and it feels good, and I keep finding new ways to do it. So I'm always intrigued. It's like you like your job. I love my job. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. You know, I come into this job.
I can tell. I
every
know.
Day.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like a little kid having a great time. You also deal with karma. And I had an opportunity this weekend. I'm back here in St. Louis for just one more week where I'm seeing friends and family.
Yeah.
And it cut my trip from Austin, Texas short where I was there. And I have a friend of mine who has incredible karma. I mean, you can tell when she goes into a room, she just lights up the place. When she decides to turn it on, if she doesn't, and she's gone through a real rough time lately, the karma has dulled, but I see it coming back now in a big way. What allows somebody to do that? I always thought karma was just there.
Well, I think it is. Of course, it's earned in the past. There are many different kinds of karma. There's five kinds that I talk about. But she had earned the right to come back as a very charismatic individual, I would assume. And yet everybody's going to be tested. They're going to have to go through the hard times to see if they've learned. So she's probably hit some of those ruts in the road. But if it's in there and if she's responding ideally the way that she hopes she would respond, in other words, if she's coming up against those snags and she's responding positively and opposed to being negative and angry and hostile, she's probably passing those soul tests that are part of all of our lives. And so she'll come snapping back. That's what I would expect from somebody that that had that, you know, that was charismatic and powerful.
Is it normal to take a step back and
yeah,
then maybe turn forward and you just keep going that way
yes,
for a while?
I think we all get tested very hard sometimes, and we end up taking steps back. But, you know, if it's in you to step back up to the plate and your orientation is that of a winner, then that's what you're going to experience. You'll come back, and you will take it on again and again and again. I've certainly had my trials where I've had to I was being squashed, you know, but, you know, at least so far I've been fighting it back. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is it true that close people in this life might have been close in a previous life and then in a previous life?
That's my experience with this. My last book was, and that's not a hype on the book, but my last book was simply about research right across the board about the sort of agreements that we make between each other in general before we come here, soul contracts or soul agreements. And as a result, the one thing I found, and this was 3 years of a lot of research, the one thing that we do all seem to pin down before we are born are the key relationships in our life, and that would be our parents, our mate, our children. That doesn't mean the relationship's going to last forever, but it's set up for us to have an opportunity to learn, to face whatever is unlearned, probably with the same person in the past. But we choose it. It's very rare, I find, anyone that has not been together in a past life, if they are married today, or if it's the parent, or if it's the kid. We have a soul history, and we come here to play that out, and we learn from each other. And even if it seems like our partner is an enemy, sometimes, of course, when a relationship has gone bad, I don't think on the other side we'd feel that way. On the other side, we would feel we had set it up as something to be played out, and we agreed to the roles. And here we are back again.
In your book, Soul Agreements, you do talk about life as if your experiences were contracted before you even born, that sometimes it's already dealt out.
Yes.
Do you believe that?
I do believe that, but I believe that it depends, it varies with everyone. One person comes in and they have agreed to a lot more free will than another person. And one person will pin their whole life down, and that's the person who would have a professional astrologer look at the chart, and it would be very, very accurate in regard to living out what is in that chart. In other words, when we're born, the astrology chart, and I'm talking now in the hands of a real professional, that's a map. That's a roadmap for our life. But other people will leave a little more free will. We still pin down the relationships, those key relationships, but there'll be major factors in everyone's chart that will be in, if I'm doing a past life regression, it will tie into what the astrology chart is saying. And we will usually, almost always, find that this person is living out the exact life that they set up to learn. So I really do believe that we all have soul agreements. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Dick, when do people stop reincarnating?
I wish I knew on that one. I think we have to come back until we get it right. And that's going to take a long time. I hear people talking about being enlightened in this lifetime, or this is the last life that they have to live. And I usually will say, well, have you let go of all the fear-based emotions then? Because if you have fear-based emotions, you certainly would not be ready to, you're not going to be evolved beyond the point of returning. So have you let go of all the guilt and all the prejudice and all the possessiveness and envy? And you go down through the long, 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 long list of fear-based emotions. And if we have any fear-based emotions, well, we're going to come back until we move through all of that, until we learn, until we have evolved, at least I would assume, into a very self-actualized way of living and being.
In these past lives, if somebody truly started to grow into their next life, mm-hmm. and then let's say something happened, something tragic happened in their life, do they still pick up and grow, or does it stop?
No, I think the tragedy would probably give them a greater opportunity than ever, George, to be able to grow. Now, this would, again, to me, would probably be a test. It's an opportunity. What are you going to do with it? And if you're going to turn angry and hostile and, again, desire revenge, you haven't grown. And so you're probably going to be failing some of your tests, which would mean to me you'll probably have to be tested again. So we can be tested over and over and over as long as it takes. There's no shortage of lifetimes. We can just keep coming back. But it'd be a lot better to learn through a little of the wisdom so that we could stop learning from the pain. We learn best through pain. Think about it. We go through something and it hurts and we decide, man, I don't want to do that again. And so we eventually learn as a result of our experiences what works and what does not. And those experiences should basically be about love or some variation of love opposed to fear.
I've always believed that the Coast to Coast listeners are enlightened. They're growing. They love the subject matter. I just tend to believe that they're a step above a lot of other people. Does that mean they might not come back again?
Well, I don't know. I would judge, first of all, by I feel that we are here to learn to let go of our fears. And that the fears are our karma, all of the fear-based emotions. So if they could truly say that, they might not be back. They might be able to move on and stay on the other side.
Let me give you Dick's website. It's DICKSUTPHEN.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His book is called Soul Agreements, and he is going to be a featured speaker this weekend in Los Angeles at the Conscious Life Expo. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment as we talk about the Knights Templar, Angels, Demons, and Gods of the New Millennium. Well, if you haven't picked up the After Dark newsletter yet, well, we're still giving you two great old shows with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms and demon possession. Art did that a long time ago. We had to pull them out of the old vault. You'll get those when you subscribe to After Dark by calling 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. Lon Milo Duquette is an award-winning writer, editor, and lecturer. He has authored 14 books that have been translated into 8 languages. And Lon is a national and international governing officer of Ordo Templi Orientis, one of the most influential initiatory societies of the 19th, 20th, and now 21st centuries. He is a high-degree Freemason and lectures worldwide on subjects such as the Hermetic Kabbalah, ceremonial magic, and the works of the 20th century's most controversial holy man, Aleister Crowley. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Hey, Lon, how are you?
I'm fine, George. Thanks for asking me on.
My pleasure. A lot of people are fascinated with the work you've done. You know, one of your books, Angels, Demons, and Gods of the New Millennium, you work, you know, about Aleister Crowley. That fascinates me. You also have done extensive work into the Knights Templar, Freemasons as well. How'd you get so widespread with all this?
Well, I don't know. It's always been my interest. My father was a Freemason, and I think his secrecy, he teased me with the secrecy of Freemasonry and what was going on, and I just sort of fell in love with the symbols and traditions of the Western mystery tradition.
Now, this organization that you're part of, the Ordo Templi Orientis,
right.
What is that?
Well, Ordo Templi Orientis, it means Order of the Oriental Templars, or Order of the Temple of the East, roughly translated. And the OTO is an international membership organization. It was founded in Germany around 1900 by high-degree Freemasons, European Freemasons and Theosophists, and it was, originally designed to be sort of an umbrella-type organization that would bring together various traditional European and Eastern esoteric movements. It's not a Masonic organization, but like the Freemasons and other degree-structured movements that helped bring about the Age of Enlightenment back in the 1700s. The OTO adopted the Knights Templar as our traditional forebears. Now, there's no true historical link, but in societies and fraternal organizations, traditional history is important as regular history.
Absolutely. Okay. Hey, tell me, why was Aleister Crowley so controversial?
Well, he acted like a 20th century guy in the 18th century or in the 19th century. He was born just a little before his time. I think if he had been born even 50 years later, we wouldn't have thought that he was too controversial at all. But for Edwardian England and for the early part of the 20th century, society was just not ready for such an outrageous and free-thinking and eccentric
individual. Was he evil at all, Lon?
Well, it depends on how strict you are with your definition of evil. No, certainly not from my point of view. But he was so outrageous in his behavior. It was almost like a shock value for shock value purpose. If you were capable of being freaked out by some of his writings or his behavior, then he didn't want to mess with you. It was sort of like a self-governing thing, and he enjoyed cultivating an infamous reputation because he truly thought and accurately thought that any publicity is better than no publicity at all. And that he thought his work was important enough that even after he died, he would want his work published, even if it was by people who hated him.
Does that
make any sense at all?
Does he have a following now?
Yes, he does. He's bigger than he ever was in his lifetime. Yes. Well, people are seeing through the sort of dark and sinister facade and really getting into the seriousness of his work. And even his most serious detractors admit that his contributions to Western mysticism and modern hermetics, magic as he called it, more than any other single individual, Aleister Crowley was the greatest contributor in the 20th century. And the Ordo Templi Orientis, as other organizations go, is not incredibly large. There's about 3,000 members worldwide. But that does make it the largest magical organization in the world.
What when you talk about magic, what kind of magic did he perform? It's not the kind of magic we see now with Chris Angel and other illusionists, right?
No, it's not. It's not prestidigitation, and I guess if this type of magic dispels illusions, it dispels illusions in the individual. It is a personal, transformational, religious, or spiritual discipline. It's the goal of magic is the enlightenment, the illumination, the spiritual liberation of the magician. It is sort of the Zen practice of the West. It's the Zen equivalent, at least in my mind, of the West. And Crowley called it magic. Its traditions go back to the practices, the doctrines, the texts of the Chaldeans, where the word magic comes from, magi, as in wise man.
Did they conjure up evil things to people, Lon? I mean, you know, did they have the old kettle brewing and things like that?
Not like that. But if you look at it as a form of psychodrama, we've all got things within ourselves that we don't have under control. And those things could easily be personified as spiritual entities.
True.
And those that we don't have under control, we may as well consider them demons until we do get them under control. And the serious practice of magic does precisely that. Crowley once said that if you wanted to learn magic and study it seriously, and you wanted to do so for very unworthy motives, say you wanted to kill one of your enemies through magic, he said, go ahead and start studying magic if you want to do that. Because by the time you actually know what magic is, by the time you really figure out what you have to do, how you have to transform and perfect yourself in order to have the power to do that, you won't want to do that after you've achieved that illumination.
Did these people, Lon, put curses on people and things like that?
In the classic sort of television show, putting curses on people, that we may see on television or in the movies, no, not exactly like that. But people are people. And in the late 1800s and early 1900s, many people in Great Britain who were studying magic belonged to an organization called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And Crowley himself was a member. And these people, some of whom were some of the brightest stars in English literature and such, very influential people.
They revered him, didn't they?
Well, They liked him at first, and then they didn't. He was a little too freewheeling for them. Yeah.
Okay, so they started off bowing to him, and then they turned on him?
Well, it wasn't that he came in as a student. It wasn't that they were bowing to him. He was an extremely talented student, and the head of the organization, McGregor Mathers, absolutely thought that the sun rose and set on Crowley, and this made the other members jealous. Okay.
Yeah, I called him Crowley. It's pronounced Crowley,
right? It's pronounced Crowley. Yes, he says it rhymes with holy.
All right, Crowley it is.
Okay.
What kind of a life did he have growing up? Do you know?
Well, he was raised in privilege. His father, Edward Crowley, had a large business in Crowley Ales. He was a brewer, and but he's a very strict fundamentalist type Protestant Christian, and Crowley was raised in a very strict moral atmosphere and such, and like many youthful people, he rebelled against that, and by the time he went to college, he was luxuriating, I guess, in his newfound freedoms and such, and so he was somewhat of a libertine. But he loved poetry. He obviously was a genius. He excelled in his studies, but he had an incredible amount of energy. It's the same sort of energy that we see in characters like Richard Wagner. They could stay up for days writing poetry and Wagner writing music, and Crowley had this incredible amount of energy, and it had to get out some way, and. But when he discovered the mystical sciences of the West, alchemy first attracted him, and then he got into the Hermetic sciences and eventually joined the Golden Dawn.
And, you know, he would be today, as you said, he, you know, a lot of people nowadays love his work. If he were publishing today, he'd probably be a New York Times bestseller, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I think he would. Although he sort of always overestimated the education and the subtlety of his readership. So it still takes. He's a difficult read even today, but today.
I always confused him with Anton LaVey, who's Satanist.
Right.
A lot of people do. They confuse him with that.
Yes. I think Crowley would not want to.
No,
would want to be compared to LaVey.
You know, Lon, I haven't even touched yet with you on Freemasonry and the Knights Templar. Can you stay with us next hour?
Sure can.
Okay, we'll do that, and we'll get Tom to get permission from our guest to see if we can push him back just a bit. Great guest coming up, Christian Wild, to talk about some incredible health issues. But I want to get into Freemasonry and Knights Templar, and only have about 6 more minutes left with you, and I'm still not done talking about Aleister Crowley.
So, okay.
So we'll do that. We'll devote next hour to the Freemasonry and the Knights Templar and your conscious life presentation, which I wish I were there for it. It's going to be gangbusters, I hear.
I think so.
Do you travel a lot talking about these various subjects?
I travel an awful lot, and I'm going to continue to travel an awful lot while I'm still young and beautiful. So I just got back from Orlando, where I was at the International New Age trade show and such. So I travel an awful lot, and I try to keep myself busy while I'm
traveling.
Still active. I'm a traveling man.
The title of your book, Angels, Demons, and Gods of the New Millennium. What the heck does that mean?
Well, it means exactly what it says, and it talks about the Hermetic science of magic, and that deals with spiritual forces within ourselves, some of which are angels, some of which are demons. And the fact that we're coming up upon a new age, I firmly believe that we are experiencing the dawn of a shift in human consciousness. And
you can feel it, can't you?
I can feel it.
Me too. And I think a lot of people can, Lonnie. It's happening faster and faster and faster.
Yep.
Are you concerned that evil could win out in this battle?
No.
Why not?
Well, the Egyptians have this image of a perpetual struggle between the god Horus and the god Set that murdered his father. Now, I think there's a great cosmic truth concealed in that particular myth, and that ultimately, if we would back our camera up to get a wide enough angle, we would see that it's less a struggle between good and evil than it is between the struggle of ignorance and knowledge. And if we could really sort of back up and look at the big picture, what some people see as evil, of course, is painful, and we want to avoid it. But at the moment, our brains aren't big enough, aren't wide enough to see what evil really is. And if we would find the true nature of evil, we would know that it would be impossible for that to win out.
So I'm beginning to believe that Mahatma Gandhi's belief of goodness and caring and love defeats evil. I think he was right.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, turning to the Egyptian gods, the god Hur Parkrot, or Harpocrates. You know, it's the one we always see, the baby with his fingers to his lips, the god,
yes,
the god of silence. Now, that's the god Horus's twin brother. And Horus is wild and crazy and vengeful and positive. But his twin brother is just the opposite. He's Gandhi-like. He's quite, and there is nothing that can withstand that much innocence, that much silence. That silence is one of the big, powerful, magical tools. And you're absolutely right. It's nothing can resist, nothing can attack something that is that innocent.
And I believe that maybe within all of us, Lon, we have the good and the bad, and that it's a constant battle. And there's no question, I think if you can defeat it, it'll always seem to present itself. And I'm talking about the good.
Mm-hmm.
But the evil part is in everybody, I think. It's there.
I think so, too. It's part of the big tapestry of life.
You know, Friday night I had an open line for doppelgangers, people who have seen their double.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's always been said that if you're a good person in life, your doppelganger is evil. And we were just getting incredible phone calls from people who had seen their evil twin. It was out there.
Wow. Well, we are this combination. That's one of the points of the angels, demons, and gods of the new millennium. The demons are part of our tapestry. We can't grow unless we overcome these things. Evolution is a process of overcoming obstacles.
Stay with us, Lon. We're going to take this break. We'll be right back with you to finish up, talk about Freemasonry, the Knights Templar. Christian Wilde, our very special guest tonight, will join us in the next hour after next hour. Okay, so he'll join us in about an hour with some incredible health news for you, and then we'll take phone calls with him later on as well. I'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.